This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Coming up, we discuss food deserts in eastern North Carolina, and an upcoming theater performance in New Bern shares the personal stories of the challenges of being female on active duty in the military. Parkinson's disease is a degenerative disorder of the central nervous system in which brain cells progressively die. According to the National Institutes of Health, about 50,000 people are diagnosed each year in the United States, and about 500,000 people have the disease. Since there is no way to detect Parkinson's using brain imaging, it usually isn't diagnosed until symptoms, such as tremors, rigidity, and impaired balance, are present. The average age of diagnosis is 60, but people can live for years with the disease and not know it. Exercise physiologist at Duke Health, Sarah Edwardson, says people with Parkinson's disease slowly stop producing a neurotransmitter called dopamine.
Since dopamine is responsible for muscle activity and motor function, it's directly correlated with sending signals to the brain. So we see these issues with overall motor function with the decreased dopamine levels.
According to the National Parkinson's Foundation, when 60 to 80% of the dopamine-producing cells are damaged, symptoms of Parkinson's disease start to appear.
We see people's gait is affected, the ability to initiate or seize movement, stiffness, rigidity, and one of the most common symptoms is a tremor. Some people may have a very, a bad tremor, but they may walk just fine, whereas some people have a very shuffling gait but have no tremor. Everyone has kind of a different symptoms that they're working to maintain and reduce.
Melinda Pincava was diagnosed with Parkinson's in 2015. She says the disease has slowed her movements and weakened her voice. It makes everyday tasks like typing at the computer and writing a letter challenging.
I would have people say this to me when I would tell them I was diagnosed. They say, oh, my grandfather had that. He had a lot of tremors. That's one person's Parkinson's. For me, it's my left side is rigid. I had a frozen shoulder. When I walk without the meds, where the meds are wearing off, it'll look like I'm limping. And there's a rigidity to my left side. I do not have tremors. About 20% of us don't have tremors.
Since her diagnosis, Pincava has been active in trying to find ways to manage her symptoms, from taking dance classes and swimming to signing up for a boxing class specifically geared to people with Parkinson's disease.
There are people who might just take medicine and think that's it. But I'm of the view that you have to do a lot of different things. As a friend says, there's no magic bullet, there's a magic shotgun. And you do this combination of the meds, the exercise, you watch your diet in a certain way.
She's also involved in an innovative new therapy that uses tandem bikes to help slow the progression of PD. Physical therapist Jennifer Smart with Village Health and Fitness started the program in Oriental.
It's a standard road tandem bike, and I put it on a trainer. So the back wheel is in a bracket, and then the front wheel's just on a little stabilizer thing. And then we have steps to get up to it because it's, it's hard for the people with Parkinson's to get on it. So it's perfectly stationary in the back.
Marsha Lors and Diane Pylon simultaneously sway from side to side, pedaling a stationary tandem bike. Lors is a volunteer with the therapy program. She's in the front seat and provides most of the strength to move the pedals at a consistent 85 RPMs.
Usually we start slower, maybe in the 60s for a few minutes, and then cool down in the 60s at the end for a few minutes. But we try to keep it at that pace.
It's a pretty rapid pace.
Yeah.
So my name is Diane Pylon. I'm not talking too clearly because I have Parkinson's.
Pylon was diagnosed with the disease in 2009. She says riding the tandem bike a couple of times a week greatly improves her mobility.
Many times, particularly in the afternoon, and at the end of my medication cycle, I come in and can hardly walk. And I ride for 45 minutes at 85 RPM and get off the bike and waltz out of here like Cinderella. And it usually gives me a couple of good hours at night.
Beside Lors and Pylon, there's another stationary tandem bike. Sarah Goodnight, the captain, rides in front, and Kim Spruill, the stoker, is in the back. Spruill was diagnosed with PD in 2010 and has been riding the tandem for about a year.
I just have more endurance now, more stamina. Even though this makes me very tired, I go home and I'm very tired afterwards. It gives me more energy, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, yeah.
My voice is going, sorry.
As a volunteer, Goodnight says she benefits from the program too, getting exercise and making friends.
It's a win-win situation. I stay fit. And best of all, I'm helping people like Kim
or any other Parkinson patient I'm working with.
The Tandem Bike Program has 7 participants with Parkinson's and about 30 volunteers. It started 2 years ago when one of Smart's friends began showing signs of PD. Wanting to help, she came across a study by Jay Alberts, then a Parkinson's researcher at Emory University, which used tandem bikes to test the effect of forced intense exercise on people with Parkinson's. He found that a rate of 90 revolutions per minute triggered an increase in dopamine activity for people with PD.
Exercise in general has always been good for Parkinson's, but it's mainly been neuroadaptive, meaning that we as physical therapists are teaching people tricks to do things, to get their body to move.
According to Smarts, forced intense exercise has neuroproductive effects, meaning it's improving or delaying the decay of dopamine neurons.
They know that they're getting more dopamine activity. They don't quite know the mechanism of that yet, but they do know that the forced intense exercise is now seen as neuroprotective. So it delays the progression of the disease.
Exercise physiologist at Duke Health, Sarah Edwardson, agrees that forced intense exercise is beneficial to people with PD.
The problem we see with Parkinson's is that because dopamine levels are low, the messages being sent to the brain for muscle activity and motor control is reduced. So the more intense the exercise, the more messages that are being sent, so you're seeing a greater response in muscle activity and motor control.
For some, the results from a vigorous ride on the tandem bike for 45 minutes to an hour are dramatic. However, Melinda Pincava says it makes her feel more balanced.
Let me put it this way. When I don't exercise, when I don't do the biking for a couple of days, I really feel it. I mean, I'm walking poorly. The symptoms that I have for Parkinson's come through.
Pincava rides 3 times a week at 6 a.m. with her tandem bike partner of 2 years, Regina Dubiel.
Yeah. It's hard to believe.
Right. Yeah.
We're married on a bike.
Pincava and Dubiel are the only participants in the tandem bike program to ride mostly outdoors instead of on the stationary trainer.
I can see in the morning when Melinda and I first get together, I watch her gait in the morning when she comes out of the house. And her gait in the morning might be a little bit stiff, maybe not as fluid. But when she gets off the bike, she is more free-flowing in her stride. I mean, you can see, and I know you feel an immediate difference just getting off the bike after that ride, that those neurotransmitters are there to just make the movements happen more naturally.
Maintaining a pace of 80 to 90 revolutions per minute can be difficult for anyone to keep for 60 minutes, especially people with PD. That's why Pincava and Dubiel motivate each other to stick with it.
2 years that we've been doing this, she has gotten so strong. There are days she pushes me. So there are times where, like, I'm supposed to be, you know, pushing us. I'll feel her behind me pushing, pushing, pushing. Sometimes I'm not really sure. Like, I think the program's more for me.
Part of the forced exercise is not just when you're on the bike. It's having made the commitment. Somebody's made a commitment to be there for you. You know, they've made this commitment of their time to take an hour or two out of their day to do that. And so, man, I've got to get myself down there to do it. There's no not doing it.
There's currently no cure for Parkinson's. There are several drugs that help treat symptoms, but none that slow the underlying neurodegeneration. Until then, exercise programs using tandem bikes is one more way people with Parkinson's can slow the progression of the disease. This is the Down East Journal. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. There are deserts in eastern North Carolina. Instead of cacti and tumbleweeds, you'll know them by a lack of nutritious food and markets with seasonal local produce sections. These food deserts can be found throughout the region despite its agricultural background. But some local residents are trying to tackle the issue head-on in their own way. Chris Thomas has this.
If you go to the new Greenville Community Garden on Stancil Drive on a Wednesday evening, you're likely to witness something not often seen close to the city's downtown: hay bales resting on garden beds. This sprouted from lessons learned last year after Hurricane Matthew. Chad Carwin, a Greenville resident and garden volunteer, explains.
Our entire space, actually, Chris, in fact, where you and I are sitting right now, was under 2.5 to 3 feet of water. And in some areas, as recently as a few months ago, you could still see the water line on the trees and the vegetation around here.
According to Carwine, the garden donated 60 to 70 pounds of food last year, But flooding from Hurricane Matthew not only washed much of it away, but also negatively impacted the soil. The hay bales are there to address that deficit by growing the crop above the soil, ensuring it's safe to eat.
And there's several benefits to that. For instance, it retains moisture quite well. It also cuts down on your need to come out and weed the bales. And it also provides its own nutrients. The hay in particular has clover in it, and it's very high in nitrogen content, which is something that the plants need to grow.
Greenville, like many towns and cities across the region, has a food accessibility issue in its most vulnerable areas. One of those areas is across the river from the garden, just outside of the city's limits.
There's a lot of individuals that don't have their own means of transportation, or it's not reliable enough to take public transit, or you know, they have certain disabilities that limit their ability to walk or ride a bike, you know, to get access to fresh local food at a supermarket.
Areas like North and West Greenville, where healthy food options are scarce and accessibility to those options are difficult to come by, are known as food deserts.
That's very prevalent. That is very prevalent. That's a large portion of our community in that situation, and we wanted to fill that need, and that's part of what we're trying to do out here.
According to Jessica Wichard, a spokesperson for the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina, it's felt most acutely where there are high rates of poverty and food scarcity.
In the areas that our two branches in Greenville and New Bern serve, there are about 200,000 individuals, a little more than that, who are food insecure, meaning that they don't know where their next meal will come from. And a third of those 200,000 are children. And a big element of that is food deserts and not having access to food, not being able to go and get it, not knowing where to get it or how to utilize it.
A map from the USDA indicates large tracts of food deserts in eastern North Carolina. Much of Northampton and Hertford counties are designated as such, as well as the eastern end of Rocky Mount and virtually all of Princeville and Edgecombe County. Wichard says another economic component to most food deserts is supermarkets, who feel those communities are a poor investment, leaving those residents with few options other than a corner market or gas station that carry less perishable, less nutritious items. This plays into a perpetual cycle of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and early death rates in these communities, many of which have disproportionately large Black and Latinx populations.
The access to those foods is not just as simple as incentivizing groceries and retail stores to move into those communities. So it really does become a cycle. It becomes a generational issue, you know, families not necessarily knowing how to pass on good nutrition and the ways to cook fresh fruits and vegetables, because it just has continued to be an issue in communities that they can't really rectify because access just isn't there.
It's one of the reasons Lee Albritton, a Kinston native, co-founded Common Grounds a decade ago. They run a community garden of their own along Martin Luther King Boulevard, which becomes NC-11.
You know, Kinston was severely flooded back in 99, and we found this wonderful piece of property with large road frontage on Highway 11, so good public exposure and easy access.
Albritton said one of the garden's main goals is to help a new generation of young people break debilitating multi-generational cycles.
And, of course, through the growing of food, letting young people understand how food is grown, where food comes from, the value, the nutritional value of eating fresh produce versus canned food or processed food.
There's also a community garden in New Bern, run by the Eastern and Central North Carolina Food Bank. Wichard says it's run by 8 volunteer gardeners, and she believes these gardens are an effective resource since the food bank can't always reach communities that need the produce most.
It's a great resource, not only for education, but as you mentioned, it's free produce that's right there. It's easy to get, and we have folks available who can also teach about planting and gardening and the benefits. You know, Eastern North Carolina is very much an agricultural area, and so to keep that kind of tradition and heritage there, I think, is important for the community in addition to the food benefits.
It's still unknown what this year's harvest will bring. The new Greenville Community Garden is still in the planting stages. Only time will tell if these radishes, collards, and peppers will grow and help create oases in Greenville's food deserts.
I would always like to see us double our production, double our yield. If we can do that, then that's, you know, that's going to grow exponentially.
I'm Chris Thomas.
This is the Downeast Journal. Warrior Women is an original theater piece that conveys the challenges of being female on active duty in the military. On May 15th and 16th, two women, Angel Pinkston and Michelle Sims, will share their personal stories through dance, song, and spoken word, conveying a message of courage, power, and vulnerability. Today, Mac McKee speaks with director and choreographer of Warrior Women, Wendy Osterman, about the performance at Oringer Auditorium in New Bern.
Let's begin with the structure of Warrior Women. Will it be presented as a combination of music, dance, and dialogue?
Yes, absolutely. We try to do a sort of seamless move from a dance into a story into maybe a song. So that's been the challenge, to weave from one medium to another.
What was your influence in the final structure and overall look of the show?
Actually, from the very beginning, I was sort of the one who said, I think we have a show here, let's work on this, because I began with Michelle Sims, who had been in the musical In the Heights, and Angel Rochelle Pinkston also was in that musical, but at first I didn't realize that she was an active duty Marine, and so I started with Michelle, and I said, Michelle came to my studio in Oriental, and I said, just tell me, you can use the first person about yourself, the second, the third person, you can say she, and just start telling me what it's like to be in the Marines as a woman. And as when she finished the improvisation, I said, we definitely have material here. I don't see that there's any room for me to perform in this at all, and who else can we get? She said, Angel. So we started working almost a year ago. Their stories became poems, they became chants, they had so much material I edited, they edited with me, and that's how it really started.
Both Ms. Pinkston and Ms. Sims are active Marines, mm-hmm. and they write their stories. And how did you incorporate these stories into a unified performance piece?
It's an interesting question, and there's a lot of variety. I'm impressed with their range. They have such a range of feeling. They're young and hopeful and resilient, and they inspire me even with their bravery, that they've encountered situations which have been uncomfortable. And in telling their stories, I think we are seeing them heal themselves, and as an audience, we kind of get a catharsis from watching them. So I think putting together an evening where there's a balance of emotions and ways of expressing it has been the goal in this.
Which came first, the music or the stories? How did you incorporate them?
Well, the stories came first. And then I said, you know, we need a song here. We need a dance here. And I drew on a lot of different music that comes from all over the world, actually. Maybe that's to make this more universal statement. I found haka, the dance, the New Zealand dance that the Maoris did and that now the football players do, that would be something to use. I do a version of a sort of fan dance that is, it's really a modern dance with some Japanese influence, perhaps. I use a salsa piece that Michelle was very fond of doing salsa, so we incorporated her movement, of course, as well. There's African music. So there's a big variety, and it gives us, I think, a lot of range.
It seems overall that Warrior Women is a show that makes us, at one, take stock of ourselves and yet do so with a sense of humor. So is it imperative to you when telling a story that a show may have a serious message, but at the same time entertain us so that we are more open to the message?
Absolutely. That's, I think, a very good point. Always asking myself, this is theater. We want to enjoy the evening. And I, as a theater goer, like to be moved. I like to laugh also. I also find humor a fascinating thing because it often comes from an almost dark place and is the flip side of tragedy, perhaps.
You have a couple of quotes, I believe, from, is it not Michelle?
Yes. Well, it happens to be Michelle in this case. To give a taste of the writing and the idea that she wrote something that I call a chant, and she performs it with Angel and the fans that they have and the Japanese music. And it goes something like this. She says, always wars, always wars. There are always wars. Bloodshed engraved in my soul. Faithful and strong, long line of warriors. Overcome fear with courage. Overcome fear with courage. Ready to die, a warrior. So I've sort of excerpted that. It's a little, it has those words in it. And I find that she's able to convey her knowledge that she can be a warrior. She can be a warrior. She's female. And there is fear that we all have, but you can overcome it with courage. I find that quite beautiful.
Warrior Women will be performed May 15th and 16th at 7:30 p.m. on the Newbern campus of Craven Community College at Oranger Auditorium. Be sure to check out the ENC events calendar at publicradioeast.org. Wendy, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Downeast Journal.
You're welcome.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here today with this edition of The Garden Journal. We're lucky to have a special guest today, Dr. David Tarpey, professor and extension apiculturalist, meaning that he specializes in bees, with North Carolina State University. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. Appreciate it.
By now, most people have heard that our honeybees and other pollinators are in trouble. Can you explain a little bit about what's going on and why we should be concerned?
Yeah, so it's really happened since 2006 when a phenomenon called colony collapse disorder hit a lot of the headlines. That was a still yet undescribed and fully understood syndrome that befell honeybee colonies. That results in their kind of mysterious disappearance and mortality. But that isn't to say that beekeepers and honeybees were having problems or weren't having problems before then. That's just when it really came to public attention. And so the problems that had befallen honeybee colonies because of that media attention really also shed a light on the problems that other bee species have been experiencing as well. So I think there's kind of a global awareness now of honeybees as social managed pollinators, as well as the native wild pollinators that are out there are experiencing these problems.
As homeowners and gardeners, why do we care? Why do we need to be concerned about this?
Well, pollinators are indispensable components to agriculture and to nature through the pollination services that they provide in commercial production agriculture. This is important for over 100 crops that we grow and rely on and about a third of everything that we eat. But as backyard gardeners, this is also important for any flowering plant that requires seed set in order for it to fulfill its life cycle.
When we look at this and the importance of bees and pollinators, do we have numbers that tell us how our honeybees did this winter, coming through the winter, and things that beekeepers need to be on the lookout for through the summer months?
So I'm going to make a distinction there between honeybees and managed colonies that beekeepers are able to keep track of versus the 4,000 or so native bee species that are wild living, and we really don't have very good baseline data or able to track their numbers as easily. So when it comes to the managed honeybee colonies, the Bee Inform partnership that we've been collaborating with since its inception does an annual survey, and those surveys are just coming out this month to ask beekeepers nationwide what their winter mortality was this past winter. So we hope to have some preliminary data coming in the next couple weeks and months. What happened the year before is being published right now, and it's about a third of the managed honeybee colonies tend to be lost every single year, which is clearly not sustainable. Unfortunately, we don't have very good baseline data on those native pollinators, so we can't really say what this winter has done to those populations.
So what can homeowners and gardeners do to help honeybees and other pollinators?
Plant habitat for bees. And this is particularly important, not just in the spring when there's lots of different floral resources out there for bees of all types to forage at, but more importantly during the dearth of the summer when there's not a lot of other things out there blooming, having a diversity of different flower resources throughout the entire year really does help promote local pollinator populations and honeybees in particular. And the thing that I like to tell people, and it really synergizes very well with backyard gardening, is to become a beekeeper yourself. We have a really excellent beekeeping community here in North Carolina. We have more beekeepers in this state than anywhere else in the nation. You can very easily join a local beekeeping club.
David, thank you so much. It was great having you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate the help.